Why do we fear running out of money?
Money is a relatively new concept for human beings, right? And particularly money in a modern world is a very, very new concept. We're talking hundreds of years. And yet our brains, the human brain, is still in the forest wondering whether it should go to the rustling leaves to see what's behind those leaves. Right? Our brain hasn't evolved. We are still fearful. So human beings exist because we didn't go and check what was behind the rustling bush. Running out of money is a massive fear, and it's a massive fear for people no matter how many zeros are sitting in their pension fund or their bank balance. So the fear of running out of money is in line with the fear of I need my money to perpetually give me a rising, you know, my costs are going to keep going up and up and up and up and up. But a couple aged 80 spends about 43% less than a couple aged 50. And so there's some other research done by the Institute of Fiscal Studies that shows people spend far, far too conservatively in retirement. And at the moment, on average, with current spending levels and rates, on average, retirees will leave about 70% of their real wealth on the table, excluding property, at age 90. And that's all because they're fearful of running out. So when you're fearful of doing something, you don't do it, do you? One of my biggest passions is to help people spend their money with freedom to allow them to create memories and experiences, not be that person that can't spend it and is going to leave a load on the table.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest topic of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, and investment advisor to wealth creators with patient capital and an infinite investment horizon. I work with families and individuals who aspire to grow wealth over a lifetime and generations through disciplined, thoughtful investments in durable, quality businesses while giving money meaning. Join me on this quest to unearth and share the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is Dan Haylett. Dan's pullback de duvet every morning purpose is helping his clients spend their time and money on what's truly important. His passion for understanding and learning about the emotional, behavioral, and financial challenges of life after work makes him a true specialist in helping clients have the freedom and confidence to take advantage of their window of spending opportunity and live their best life. He likes golf, reading, coffee, and getting up at 5 a.m. He doesn't like oysters, big egos, and Crocs. Today we talk about money, and specifically about the topic of humans versus retirement. You'll hear about the term retirement rebel, and you'll find out how to become one. My guest will help us dispel some money and retirement myths. We'll take on one of the biggest fears, the fear of running out of money. Then we'll discuss some mindset shifts, and he'll explain why the concept of retirement is flawed. Stay tuned until the end when we'll learn how money can make us happy and truly wealthy. Please help me welcome Dan Haylett. All right. Hi, Dan. How are you? So nice to see you.
You too. Thank you very much for inviting me on. Can't wait for the conversation.
Well, you know that I've been following your work and listening to your podcast and reading your blog, and you share quite a bit on Twitter as well. And I think we have a lot of topics in common. I manage money for individuals. You're focused on retirement, and retirement is one of the topics that keeps coming back in many different ways. Some people are excited about it. Some people are nervous about it. But you've done a lot of work and research on the topic, and people come to you looking for answers. But before I ask you about that, I'm curious about Dan. And I like to start these conversations about those early days, your childhood upbringing. I'm curious if you can share with us how you think that time shaped you, and especially your relationship with money and curiosity about, you know, the career that you're on. It started somewhere.
Yeah, it did. It is interesting, is it? Because I ask a very similar question of clients, right? We know that our childhood upbringing has big influence on the way that we think and deal with money. Yet until someone like you asks me, it's really difficult for me to kind of answer that question. So thank you for asking it. It's cool. I suppose if I go back right to the early days, I had a reasonably fractured childhood in that my parents were never together. They divorced or separated before I could remember. So, although I had a relationship with both, it's never the same, right? It's never the same. And then my mum remarried. I was with my mum. And my stepfather was, and if I think about those days about money specifically, and I'll get onto kind of how I think that might have shaped the character in a second, but money was always a thing to beat someone up with. When I look back at that time, it was always a, you know, whenever there was arguments, whenever there was disagreement, money was always the thing that that he used to kind of use as a weapon, so to speak, against it. And until you get to a point where money becomes influential in your life, you don't realize how much of an impact that's kind of had, I suppose. And I look back on my childhood and I think I've definitely reacted in a way that I've done the opposite. Now, it's a very subconscious thing I think I've done, but all of the negativity I saw around money, all of the negativity that I had around some other stuff that was going on during my childhood, I think, you know, you can often go down that path. You can kind of mimic and go down that path, or you can hopefully feel like you've learned lessons and go the other way. So money was always an element of control. It was always an element of, and it was never kind of a wealth thing. It was just a thing, as I said to you. So I've always been very conscious that when it comes to money, I feel like I've never let it control me, and I've always felt like I've used it, even growing up, for a way that is good, i.e. to make me feel good, to spend my time on the things that I want, etc. And that's followed me through a lot into my career, which we can absolutely get onto. So yeah, I definitely see those nuggets of early childhood negativity around money and me going, no, I don't want that. And I understand the stress and the bad stuff that can bring out in people, and I see money as a force for good, not a force for evil.
I like the sound of that. You know, I'm 43, and I find it fascinating to pause sometimes and look at those very early days, like the first memory when I even tried to understand the concept of money, because as kids, we don't really get it, where things come from and how it all works, but to actually see the context. And I was sitting in the middle of a conference the other week, and I was looking around, and these are all investors, money people. And I was thinking for a moment, it's a very unique collection of people that decided to devote their lifetime one way or the other, but to money, pursuit of it, preserving it, growing it, not losing it, whatever it is. But it's really fascinating. And I think if you ask all of them, and if they really did what you did with me right now and dove into those early days, you could find something fascinating. Why do you care so much? Why is it important?
Yeah. And actually, I look at the outcome of that, right? So I look at, you know, without getting into detail, that the childhood upbringing wasn't that great. I mean, I had an okay time. My stepdad wasn't a particularly nice person, and we don't need to get into all the I look back and I look at all that stress that caused everybody, and it was for nothing. He passed away last year, and he passed away with nothing, right? And my mum's got nothing. And so, you know, and I think he was a bit obsessed by money, but they seemed to spend it as much as they got it. And, you know, you look at the outcome of all of that, and the outcome is nothing. My mum has had to now, you know, really upend her life. She's had to do things that really you shouldn't have to do in your 60s to be able to start to live a life, and, you know, equity release or reverse mortgages and all that stuff. And so you think, well, actually, the outcome is rubbish. The journey was horrendous, and the outcome is rubbish, right? Is it? So, you know, we need to learn lessons about that. And obviously, I deal with a lot of people that have been wildly successful in their careers and accumulated money. And I think, like you said, it's a unique thing. It's a unique. You put a bunch of people together that run money, that manage money, that look at money, and I think it takes on this. It takes on this thing that it shouldn't be. It has its own little world of its own, and right. And it starts becoming bigger than it should be, and controlling. And I kind of always try and root people back to, and again, I, you know, many books have influenced my thoughts over this, but root people back to the outcome. At the end of the day, we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. And without being too morbid, and the outcome is that you're gonna, if you don't use the money for good, most people will end up in later life with huge amounts of regrets, mm-hmm. no matter who you are. So yeah, I think that's kind of the basis of where I come from with it.
I like the idea of giving money meaning, you know, having a context. So people get into investing to turn a small amount to a larger amount, but managing money for people over the last two decades, what I grew to appreciate is the people behind the portfolios and the importance, the significance that money has in their life. And I can see how it opens options, it gives them peace of mind, gives them control, freedom, all those things that you can't really quantify. And it's not that you have to spend that money. Sometimes just knowing that it's there, it's sitting, it's waiting, it's enough. Yeah. You know, it's like that umbrella in the pocket that you don't need it, but it's there. So if it starts raining, it's fine. It's not the end of the world. Yeah. It won't ruin your day. I'm going to jump into to retirement talk, but I want to ask you about podcasting, because you and I share the same journey. And I saw how you share some comments about the different experiences you have. And I think you shared a story how some people found you, recommended through somebody. They ended up listening to a number of episodes, and then they drove to see you. Can you share that story? I found it fascinating how the worlds collide and people find you.
It's been amazing. And actually, before I share that story, I had an initial chat with someone about an hour and a half ago that actually comes from further away in the UK than that particular person that has found me through the podcast and wants to start working with me. It's fascinating, right? You kind of put work out into the world, you put thoughts out into the world, you put conversations that you hope have an impact and you hope kind of helps people. But this particular guy, his friend, who I still don't know, his friend knew that he was thinking about retirement and said kind of, well, you need to listen to this podcast that I've discovered, because everything that we've discussed about retirement has been nothing to do with money. It's been to do with what you're going to do with your time and all that stuff. And there's this person talking to all these people across the world that talks very similar. Listen to it. Uh-huh. And he kind of binged listened to, I think we got kind of first two seasons of the, maybe we were a couple of episodes away from finishing season two, and he binged it all and made contact with me and said, Dan, I'd really like to set up a time to have a chat with you. Because I think what you say can resonate with me and my wife. And we had that really wonderful chat. And what was really interesting about that chat is I done very little talking. He was basically repeating everything that I talked about. So he was kind of, you know, and his opening line was, I feel like we've already met and I feel like I know you, which is just the most amazing thing, right? It's kind of like that trust barrier that you absolutely need in order to help people with this such crucial stage has already been broken down, because they get to see you, they get to hear you, and they get to kind of understand what you're about. And he lived 2.5 hours away. And I said, would love to meet with you. Do you want, you know, should we do this via Zoom or should I come to you? He's like, no, I want to drive down. I want to see you. I want to be your office and meet the team. Yeah, and we're kind of working on their retirement plans right now. So, and that's, there's another, again, the guy that I spoke to this morning, there's another two people that have come kind of through the podcast that have directly got kind of hold of some of this, some of those conversations, and something's resonated, and they've made contacts and, you know, think we can help them, which is amazing.
It's pretty remarkable. You know, I've been writing articles for many, many years. I wrote a few books, and people reached out and connected with me because of that, made friends or, you know, business opportunities. But I think a podcast, it's a whole different experience. It's very real. It's very authentic if you let it be. And it's one of those experiences where if you're not into it, or if the guest or the host is not into it, you're not going to listen. You're going to switch it off. You might leave your Netflix TV series on for an hour because you want some noise in the room, but you're not going to listen to somebody in your headphones that you feel like they don't really care about what they're talking about. And you create that connection. And I have similar stories that you shared. You know, I sat down and I had dinner with somebody that connected with me, and they talked to me for an hour and a half because they feel like they have to catch up to the level that they have with me, knowing me already so well, and they're giving me a chance to get to know them. And it's a really remarkable experience where they feel like, because they've heard me talk about so many different topics and some, you know, very personal stories as well, they feel that they already know me. They want me to have a chance to get to know them. It's pretty remarkable. Mm. I really was very touched by that experience.
Absolutely. It's kind of that. They almost feel like, I know you. Am I right to work with you? It's like it's that kind of which is amazing. And also beyond that, for me, it's been the client thing has been amazing, but I've made so many, you know, amazing connections outside of kind of clients. It's got me some amazing opportunities to speak, to write, to do things that, you know, people have come across the podcast that have said to me, "Oh, can you write for my particular site? Can you come and speak at this particular event on some of those topics?" So, I think podcasting's absolutely amazing. I think it is just, as you said, the ability to build those connections is second to none.
So let's jump right in. I'm curious about the myths around retirement. I feel like we know the term, but you've done an amazing job defining the myths and dispelling the myths. So share some of those with us.
Yeah, we could probably spend an hour on this, couldn't we?
But I'll try some of the big ones.
I'll try and distill some down. I think I've got three or four that I think are really, really important to understand. And there's many myths, right? I think this isn't actually one of them that I've thought about, but the word retirement is a myth. Uh-huh. It's a man-made invention, and I'll get onto kind of everything about retirement as we progress, but it's a man-made thing that was invented by people because they couldn't physically work anymore. And they needed to do something, and they needed some sort of help to be able to fund a very, very small part of their life. People didn't get a state or government pension that often because they died before they were eligible for it, right? That's kind of, and we're only going back 100 years. The industrial age meant that people were more, they were working physical jobs, and they got to aged 50 to 60 and they physically were done. They could not do anything anymore. And they spent 2, 3, 4 years in retirement and then died. So this whole notion of retirement is a myth, number one, right? But we'll get into that. I think the biggest myth about retirement for me is that people believe it's a money problem, and it's not. It's a human problem. Retirement is more of a human problem than it is a money problem. And there's so much focus on the number. How much do I need? How much is enough? That they forget about actually the biggest problem with retirement. And there's loads of research out there, academic papers and research from people like us that sit in front of clients and speak about this stuff all the time. But, you know, the problem around loss of identity, the loss of purpose, how you're going to spend time, the structure that work gave you and all of that, it's bigger than money. I know many people that have got more than enough that struggle to retire because all they've done is focus on what they're retiring from, not what they're retiring to. So number one, I think if we can at least give it the same amount of airspace, human problem, money problem, we're going to be in a better place. But I think if we can understand that there's a lot of work to be done on a human level, then many people will put themselves in a much clearer space about their retirement. I also think, kind of on that, I think for far too long, people's retirements have been dictated by other people, mm-hmm. i.e. they feel like they're dictated by the state or the government, or when people say they can access their pension pots. They're dictated by their friends down the golf club or their colleagues that they've seen retire. I think too many people have this relative mindset, not an absolute mindset, when it comes to their retirement. They look at other things, they're dictated, oh, I'm not retiring until I'm 65 because that's when I can get social security or state pension or government help. I'm not retiring until then because my best friend didn't retire till 66. And I think, you know, dictated by someone else, again, is another myth. You need to kind of, this is your unique journey. And there are many ways that people can retire early, retire late, continue working, etc. So I think that's a big myth that's there. And another one for me would be actually kind of speaking into your line of work, really, around investing. So this, the myth around investing in safe assets, mm-hmm. This kind of thing where people go, I need to hold more bond exposure, more safe asset exposure as I approach retirement and into retirement, is actually one of the things that I think could really hurt their retirement. One of the biggest challenges for people that are entering into a retirement is their future purchasing power, inflation, effectively, right? So,
right.
You know, you need to ensure that your money can buy you stuff in 20 years' time and can afford the basics. I think that if we go all in fixed income, we're all into a disaster. People shy away from equities because they don't understand the difference between volatility and risk. And that's a big, big problem. So this myth around I need to hold my age in bonds, or I need to make sure that I've got, you know, I'm de-risking my assets in order to make sure that I protect their valuation, is such a mistake and such a big myth. I think we need to make sure that we are understanding that we could be investing for the same time period in retirement as we did saving for retirement, is another one. And then on top of that, I think the 4% rule is the biggest load of rubbish that I've ever heard in my life. So that's another myth that we might need to explore as we get into running out of money or spending money, which I know is a topic that we want to talk about.
Now, I think it's that transition that I see with my clients when you live on a salary and you know how much is coming. And then you live off of your capital. And I work with people with inherited wealth, people that had a liquidity event or a big compensation from a company. And it feels very sudden. And it's a substantial amount of money that in some cases gives them the option not to work or to work less going forward, or maybe be occupied with projects that don't bring money, right? And then it's that moment where you kind of mentally freeze a certain amount that you see that you have right now, and you will have to live off of that amount. And I think it's more mental, emotional than financial, that the volatility is seen in a different way, because you kind of feel like you can't make it up with the salary coming in anymore. And especially in retirement later on, when you know you're not going to look for a job that paid as well as you were paid at the peak of your earning power, I think it becomes kind of an emotional decision here that I don't want to see my portfolio down 30%, even if it only lasts 6 months. It might be a very long and painful 6 months. So I think that's what kicks in. A little bit of it is the risk volatility misconception, but part of it, I think it's a very emotional thing. I don't want to see my portfolio down 30-40%. I don't know how to live with it. I think that's a big thing for a lot of people that comes up.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, and the amount of people that I start to work with that have this mindset around, I want to live off the dividends or interest, the capital. I want to protect the capital amount, and it's that kind of mindset. It's, I don't want to see the capital go down. That makes me feel uncomfortable. And the trouble with that is that that's what the capital's job's been, is there to do, right? You, again, you talk about giving money a job. Your capital is there to be depleted. That's it, right? Because you can't spend it when you're dead. So it's there to be depleted. Now, there might be certain goals that you have along the way around legacy or giving money and all that stuff, but that's part of your spending. The emotional impact of short-term volatility is much heightened in retirement, as you said, because there isn't a replacement function coming in that feels like. But again, we need to be comfortable in how we've prepared our spending plans to make sure that we feel okay when the markets fall by 10, 20%, because there are other ways that we are going to be able to source income, and therefore we can protect some of the capital. But I'm not protecting it because I don't want it to go down. I'm just protecting it because I want you to feel emotionally stable to spend it in the future. And it's a real challenge. And actually, I think a big reason why people come to work with us is that retirement income planning that they need psychological and emotional help with, because doing it yourself is a really challenging thing.
Very much so. I want to ask you about the term that you use, a retirement rebel. How do we become one?
Great question. I think we all are them now, personally, right? So I think this is one of my central theses out there is that this, I think people now retiring are first generation retirement rebels. And I've got my 6 points of definition that I'll go through in a second. But I do, again, I go back to that generational thing. I look at my parents and my grandparents. And maybe my grandparents. I'm a little bit younger. I'm in my early 40s too. So, but I look at the people that I work with that are in their mid 50s, early 60s in general, and they refer to their parents, and their parents didn't have the opportunity to be as rebellious in their retirements as this generation had got. They lived on a much more structured retirement. They worked until they couldn't work anymore, and then they had a kind of a defined benefit type final salary pension that give them more structure, less flexibility effectively. And there wasn't that, the world wasn't as open, you know, for them in terms of the thirst to travel, the want to pursue other passions. And I think, you know, people are a lot more, they're different in a mindset now. So I think we're all now moving into being retirement rebels, where we don't believe retirement is a concept that we want to buy into. Our financial situation is very, very different. We are living longer. We know that money is going to need to be provided for a longer period of time. So my definitions of retirement rebels or kind of the rebellion against retirement, and I've gleaned this from looking at working with lots of people over the last few years and trying to get some common characteristics from them. So 6 points are, number one is they want to be free from the corporate shackles to explore. I think that's a really, you know, they a lot of people have had successful corporate careers, but they get to a point in life that's typically earlier than normal, early to mid 50s, maybe a little bit later than that, where they get sick and tired of corporate life. And they're going, actually, this is now restricting me. I feel like I want to explore. They want to continue to grow, learn, and have purpose. They understand that, you know, there's a thirst for more knowledge. I think that, you know, they want to continue. They understand that growth is important. They like learning, and they understand that purpose is so important. Lots of people are now more creative. They're more adventurous, and they thrive on new challenges. So they want to unleash their adventurous side, their creative side. They like challenges, and they want to make sure they continue to do that. They hate being referred to as retired. They don't like the word. If they were at a barbecue and someone said, "What do you do?" they wouldn't answer with the word, "I am retired." They would want to answer with something that is different. And also, I think there's dreams, goals, and ambitions that are unrealized that needs to be realized. You know, they haven't been fulfilled in this work that they've had, so they've got other things they want to do. And lastly, they're happiest when doing fun, interesting, exciting, and slightly scary stuff. So that's my kind of retirement rebels. And it's really interesting because so many people I work with have a number, not all of them, but a number of those characteristics in common. And I think it is a trend that we're definitely seeing in a modern day retiree or a modern day person in their mid to late 50s, that they absolutely want to be able to transition to another, you know, whether we call it the second act, the third phase, their victory lap, their financial freedom. You know, they don't want this, I'm going to stop and retire. There's a whole new life to be had. And that's what I believe retirement rebels are.
What I'm hearing is reclaiming ownership of your life in a way, right? Like seeing what else you can do. And then the initial career, maybe it's not everything that you could do, especially if it wasn't one that truly fulfilled you. I find it fascinating. You touched on something that really struck a chord with me. You said how when people think of retirement, somehow they think in terms of, oh, I just have a few more years left. But the truth could be that you could have 20, 25 years of retirement. I think my grandma retired over 20 years ago. She's still in good health and approaching 90. And when you think about it, that's half of the time that she worked. Now she's retired. That's a long time to do other things and pursue other things. And she's done a remarkable job taking advantage of that extra time. But when I think of investing, you touched on it briefly, I think of an infinite investment horizon with my clients. It's usually wealth that will last their lifetime and many lifetimes. But when they approach that retirement age, in some way that investment horizon kind of shrinks in their head, that they have less time. But you could still have two more decades to go. And you want to live those.
If not more.
And you want to take advantage of that time. So your investment horizon doesn't really shrink to 3 years and you have to sit on cash. And I think it's a very powerful revelation. I'm glad you brought it up, but I think it's a very uncomfortable topic. But it's a very open-ended, there's so much more and you could have years and years to do so many more things. I think it's a beautiful way of looking at it. The things you could be still excited about. So let's talk about the scary ideas that people have about retirement, some of the fears, and one of them you brought up briefly was the fear of running out of money. What are the fears around retirement, and why do we fear running out of money?
Yeah, so that fear of running out of money is perfectly rational for human beings. So I've done a lot of work and still trying and delve into us as human beings because it enables us to understand our reactions to events, particularly when it comes to money. Money is a relatively new concept for human beings, right? And particularly money in a modern world is a very, very new concept. We're talking hundreds of years, And yet our brains, the human brain, is still in the forest wondering whether it should go to the rustling leaves to see what's behind those leaves. Right? Our brain hasn't evolved. We are still fearful. So human beings exist because we didn't go and check what was behind the rustling bush. We went, I don't know what it is, and actually I'd rather not find out, because if it's something that'll eat me, it'll eat me. And if it's not, I'll just run. Whereas some of our brothers and sisters that were about at that time are not about now, because they were curious and they went and checked it out and then they got eaten and then they don't exist. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our brains are still there. So my thing here is our fears about retirement. People kind of beat themselves up because they go, I'm being irrational. I've got money. I'm never going to run out. But no, you're being perfectly rational, because a fear of running out of money is baked into kind of thousands and thousands and thousands of years of how we've evolved as human beings or not evolved, and how we're now presented with this brand new thing called money, which is the modern version of something is rustling in the bushes. Right. So running out of money is a massive fear, and it's a massive fear for people, no matter how many zeros are sitting in their pension fund or their bank balance. And so that, you know, it, 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 it's a fear that we latch onto, because running out of money to us now is a failure. Okay, if we are very successful and we've done very well, and then we enter into retirement and there's a chance that we're going to run out of money, that means that we're not that successful. We've let people right. down. Mm-hmm. We've let our family down. We've let all this down. So you have to kind of start to package what that fear is. And running out of money simply is not the right way to look at it. It's a fear of letting people down. It's a fear of not being able to live. It's a fear of regret. It's a, you know, it's all of the things that leads into. So I think it's the number one fear, but I'm going to bring some reality to the situation now, because I think whenever we start to think fearfully about things, what human beings love to do is now get to understand some facts. So we like dealing in certainty. That's kind of why running out of money is a really challenging thing, because it's uncertain. If, you know, the big thing is the day we're going to die, right? If we knew the day we were going to die, we probably wouldn't be sitting here, because it would be a very simple maths equation. So the fear of running out of money is the fear of the unknown. So what I try and do with people is go, actually, I can bring some knowns to this. There's huge amounts of research out there now from across the globe that looks at journeys of people in retirement. So the International Longevity Center, which is, they do some great research, they found that spending declines progressively in real terms by about 1% a year in retirement. Mm-hmm. So the fear of running out of money is in line with the fear of, I need my money to perpetually give me a rising, you know, my costs are going to keep going up and up and up and up and up. But a couple aged 80 spends about 43% less than a couple aged 50. We just need to kind of think about this, right? We know that, and I've got a model that I'll share with you, but we know that as we age, our lifestyle will be different. We know that we won't be as physically able in our 80s than we will be in our 60s. We know we might not be as mentally able in our 80s and 90s as we are in our 60s. We know all this stuff, yet we don't apply the logic to the way that we're going to spend our money. So what we're going to spend our money on and the way we're going to spend our money is totally different throughout our retirement journey. So I think that's really, really important to understand when people think about running out of money. So there's some other research done by the Institute of Fiscal Studies that shows people spend far, far too conservatively in retirement. And at the moment, on average, with current spending levels and rates, on average, retirees will leave about 70% of their real wealth on the table, excluding property, at age 90. And that's all because they're fearful of running out. So when you're fearful of doing something, you don't do it, do you? Right. You know, that's the thing. We're fearful of what's behind the bushes. We don't go and check what's behind the bushes. We're fearful of running out of money. We don't spend it. And what you end up doing is that you end up leaving far too much. Because again, you talked about this investment journey, right? I think if you invest reasonably wisely with more in equities than bonds and you leave it there for 25 years, history tells us you're going to get a decent level of return, right? Even if you do nothing. So they get to a point in their 80s when they go, I'm not going to run out of money now, am I? I'm really comfortable. Oh, I can't spend it because I'm now physically and mentally unable to. So that's a bad thing. And the biggest thing for me there is that if you do have money and no time or health, then it's not the money. You've left memories and experiences on the table, not pounds and pence or dollars and cents. You've left memories and experiences. And that's one of the biggest regrets of people that get to that point when they've still got 50, 60% of wealth on the table. They look back and go, well, I could have spent a lot more, couldn't I? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest challenges when it comes to this. It's the facts present one thing, but our fears are saying something else. And that's where I see a lot of the good work that we do is bringing the reality to the table and planning with reality and showing people that, you know, that they can spend money at a time when they absolutely need to spend it. And the model that I use is around the timeline of retirement. So it's five phases. Ultimately, I call it kind of the retirement rapture model. So you've got this pre-rapture. This is the moment as you're approaching retirement, you're spending money, you're saving money. It's a really, really interesting part of your life in your 50s. You've then got the transition. So you're going from a career to a retirement. You've then got this rapture phase, which is when actually your spending should be as high as it's ever been. You're in a phase now of life where health and time is predominantly on your side. You then go into post-rapture. We slow down. We go into our slowing down years. And then at some point, if we're lucky enough to make it, we all end up in fragility. We all end up fragile. So our money, our spending our money in our fragile years and our post-rapture years is going to be a lot less than we should and really could spend in our rapture years and our transition time. And so it's just presenting all this to people. And it doesn't mean that their fears completely go away, because, again, it's perfectly rational to fear that. But we need some facts in this, because one of my biggest passions is to help people spend their money with freedom to allow them to create memories and experiences, not be that person in their 80s and 90s that can't spend it and is going to leave a load on the table.
It almost sounds like we have to learn to spend later on. I wrote down some notes, but I was thinking, you know, for the kids and grandkids listening, there might be quite a bit of capital coming your way in the next generation. I think there's a big talk about
that wealth transfer thing is because, you know, because your parents and grandparents actually haven't done a great job in retirement, right? You shouldn't have any money left. And actually, one of my big things is about giving your money away with a warm heart, not a cold hand. So why would you leave it till the end of life to give money away when actually, you know, my biggest tip for people is give your money to your children, your grandchildren when they need it. So you can see the impact of that gift. You know, and I think people that are leaving massive amounts behind or massive legacies that they've never that's never really been part of their plan haven't done a particularly great job in retirement, and they could have done a lot more
preparing for it themselves and the next generation. I like that. You talk a lot about the challenges and the mindset shifts required to redefine retirement, and you touched on some of them today, but can we dive in a bit more? What are the challenges and what are the key mindset shifts that we should be aware of?
Yeah, I think I'll go back to what I said, that kind of the system is still wired and ingrained in an industrial age philosophy, right? This kind of work till I don't want to anymore and then stop. I think the mindset shift of hard stop retirements needs to go away. This kind of flexibility to, I suppose, design a life that you want and how you live, and You can work part-time, you can stop, you can have a sabbatical for a year and go back and work, and you can do three or four mini retirements over a 10, 15-year period. And so I think that, you know, getting over that system that's still ingrained. And also, I think people in their 60s need to place a lot of value on themselves. I often start working with people where I don't think they fully recognize the knowledge and wisdom they've got in the tank. And they start to act and talk in a way where their contribution may be done. And my outlook is for people that the mindset shift is actually you can contribute a hell of a lot to society. You can contribute a hell of a lot to the younger generation. You can contribute a hell of a lot to workplaces. You don't have to work for them. You can consult for them. You can volunteer. You can spend more time with your family and your children. You can spend more time in schools or, you know, whatever that looks like. But the mindset shift that you are now finished, there's huge amounts of knowledge and wisdom that you have got that you can significantly contribute to society. Excuse me. And that makes us feel good. But again, we know that humans love to contribute. We know that we like being part of a tribe and we like our voice being heard. So if we retire to a life that doesn't have contribution and doesn't have meaning, that's a pretty unhappy retirement. So I think that's, you know, that and the mindset shift around work, right? I mean, Work equals purpose. So figure out something you love doing and go do it. Forget work equals money. Work equals purpose. I mentioned about absolute terms, not relative ones. This mindset shift, and it's so hard. I think modern day retirees now will face this more so than actually, this is one of the challenges they face more so than previous generations of retirees. But this kind of thinking in absolute terms, not relative terms, there's more ability to compare ourselves to anyone now. Our parents and grandparents could only compare themselves to the people that lived in their street. We can now compare ourselves to anyone across the world by going onto TikTok or Twitter or whatever it looks like. And so that mindset shift around going, actually, this is not a relative thing anymore. I'm not now worrying about if I'm earning more than my peer group. I wrote about this. The research is fascinating, isn't it? That if you said to someone you can earn £100,000, but everyone else you know earns £200,000, or you know that thing, or you can earn £75,000, but everyone around you earns £30,000. Like mm-hmm. the amount of people that choose £70,000 or is ridiculous. We're working in relative terms. It's like, oh, I want to earn more than my peer group. So I think that, again, that mindset shift that we need to be really conscious of to redefine our retirements is what's important to us, what's important to our immediate circle, think in those absolute terms. And then I mentioned a few phases, right? Think of ban the word retirement. If I could ban it tomorrow, I would, but it's so ingrained in society that it would be very difficult to. But one of my tips is to come up with your own word, but think of it as a next phase, a second act, a victory lap, a third phase, that kind of upward movement. It's kind of whatever you want to call it, you know, financial freedom, financial independence, whatever that looks like, you know, have a growth and abundance mindset and think of it as the thing you're moving towards, the thing you're moving forward with.
You touched on so many fascinating points, but I wrote down a couple that I wanted to come back to. But there's this idea of the neighbor getting richer faster than you. I think it gets a lot of people in trouble just investing alone. And then the peer group that you choose to compare yourself with, I think it's a very tricky and maybe even a dangerous territory, right? So you go to high school and you only know the kids in high school, and you go to college, it's a whole new group of kids, and you're competing against a very different level probably of skill and talent. And then at work, it's the same, but you're right that these days with social media, we compare ourselves with everybody of your age around the world. And I think it can invite a lot of unnecessary pressure and tension that may not help. You mentioned financial independence, and I had a couple of guests that talk about financial independence on the show. I had Jacob Lundfisker that talks about early retirement extreme, a very fascinating pursuit on its own, and Brad Barrett from Choosify that talks about financial independence. The reason I bring them up, I'm thinking if maybe we should have some practice rounds in terms of retirement early on in our lives, so that we are prepared and we know what it's all about. And I'm just looking at myself, I went from school to another school, straight to an internship, straight to a job, straight to the next firm, founding another firm and so on. And looking back, I never really had a true sabbatical, a pause and a break. So I haven't had any experience. I have experience working. I have no experience retiring.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think that there is some room for, you called it a mini retirement, but maybe something we practice in our 30s, maybe in our 40s, maybe even earlier, just take 6 months off and see what it feels like when the work, the career is off the table for a brief period of time. Just see how it feels.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. A couple of things, right? I think we need to make sure that so I get people to look back. When I talk about the challenges of the transition from a successful career to the next phase, whatever that looks like, I think one thing I will say is that we need to look back and understand that actually we have been through many transitions in life. So it feels like it's a big deal. It absolutely is a big deal. But if we look back and think about some of those transitions that we've been through actually the transition of retirement is not that much different. I went through a retirement of sorts when I left my really, I worked in investment management in the City of London for big investment management groups. And all of the things that I help people with in their 50s and 60s to retirement, I went through in my mid 30s. Lack of purpose, lack of passion, didn't understand what, you know, where's my direction going? I feel like I can do something else. So I actually transitioned and done what I would say is almost like a retirement of itself. So I think that's one thing for me. Think about those transitions. The other thing, I spoke to the wonderful Christine Benz of Morningstar, who I've been on her podcast. She came on mine and we had some great conversations. And I spoke to her. She'd gone from her home in Chicago to Florida for what she called a pre-retirement. So she's in her 50s and she's gone, I've labeled this thing. I'm now doing a trial run for 6 weeks. I'm going to come down and I'm going to have a look and spend some time with my husband. Because that's another thing, right? I mean, you know, your relationship with your husband, your wife or your partner changes because you haven't spent that much time together for ages. So I think trial runs are really important. Do some pre-retirements. It doesn't have to be a year. It can be 8 weeks. It can be 12 weeks. It can be a month. But just start thinking about this, particularly in your late 40s, early 50s. There are things that you can do to be able to feel like you can do a couple of little test goes at this. Figure out where you might want to be. Go visit those places. If you've always wanted to move to a certain town or city or by the coast, go and have a look around. Go and get an Airbnb for a month or so and just figure out what this might look like. We trial run a lot of stuff in our life, but retirement's probably one of the biggest moments we've got, and we don't feel like we can do that, but we absolutely can.
I'm thinking of a movie. It was called About Schmidt with Jack Nicholson. I don't know if you know the movie. And he retires from a big insurance company in Omaha. And it's such a clear cut from one day he has a place to go, a purpose and something to do with his life. And the next day he has absolutely no plan, no agenda. He still puts on his suit and sits at his desk at home and even goes to the office to ask if he can help with anything because he feels that he hasn't tied all the ends, that there's something still left to be done. And that movie should be a documentary, but I think it highlights the point that you're making, how kind of a brash, harsh moment it can be if you're not ready for it. Dan, you write how money can make us happy and truly wealthy. You wrote an essay about it. Can you tell me more? How can money make us happy and truly wealthy?
Yeah, there's a lot of studies out there, aren't there, about this kind of $80,000 or $70,000 limit. It's kind of, you know, makes us happy to a certain degree, and then the happiness doesn't kind of go up much more thereafter in earnings. But money can make us happy, but only to an extent. And it's what we do with it that brings that kind of true wealth, happiness and joy. And all the research out there suggests that there are three things that we could do with our money that can bring us the most happiness and make us feel truly wealthy. So one of them is buy our way out of doing things we hate or suck up our time. So, for instance, I hate washing my car. It's the best £11 I spend because I take it down the car wash and someone does it for me. Okay. So, but again, we don't have to think of big things, right? I mean, it's, you know, and Carl Richards, who's a good friend, said something really profound actually last year. And he said it many times, but I heard it for the first time last year. Create a hate list, a do not want to do list. These bucket lists are great. But if you create this thing, what don't I like doing, from cutting grass to washing my car to booking my holidays to, I don't know, there's a whole, and it could be other bigger things, right? I don't like my job. I don't like the, use your money to buy your way out of doing the things that you hate and suck up your time. Money will make you happy. Use it to buy new and novel experiences with the people that you love. So experiences are the root of joy. And find out what you want to do, find out who you want to do it with, and use that money to do it. And again, this, the simplest things are the things that has the biggest impact. You know, just going to the theatre with your wife because you've never had the opportunity or your husband to do it. This isn't a, I need to go and do a world cruise, or I need to make sure I first fly first class to Australia to watch a sporting event or whatever that might be. But think of these things and plan it. So buy new and novel experiences with the people you love. And thirdly, give it away. So the research out there that says that giving away our money and time in brackets makes us really happy is so true. So true. So those three things can really, you know, we can align our money to those three things. And I know that will make us feel truly wealthy.
I like the idea here that it's a means to an end. And if you use it well, spend it well for yourself and other people, it will have a meaning, importance, and it will put a smile on your face too. I like that idea. Then in your writing, you introduced the concept, a Japanese concept of kanreki, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, and it implies that life starts after 60. Can you talk about that? What's that all about?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Japanese way of life. And there's another one called Ikigai, which I use a lot with clients, which is about aligning purpose and passion. But Kanreki is really interesting because it basically right in the wheelhouse of second phase of life. So basically, Kanreki, the definition is return to calendar. That's kind of what it means. So the traditional Japanese calendar follows a 60-year cycle. So once it's over, when you get to the end of the 60-year cycle, it starts again. So it basically means a rebirth or a second childhood. So it's a philosophy that embodies that kind of rejuvenation and beginning of a new life cycle at age 60. And so that concept, although has changed a little bit in modern Japanese society, it still very much celebrates kind of wisdom, experience, and contributions to society. And they have parties, right? They throw parties for people that celebrate Kanreki. They celebrate getting to the end of the calendar cycle. And they celebrate basically passing over of responsibilities. So what people end up doing is that they take people that celebrate Kanreki, they get to age 60, they end up taking on advisory roles, less demanding roles, and passing the baton of responsibility to younger generations. So whether that's work or families, what they do, it's kind of a, you know, we're looking forward now. I've got to the end of the calendar. I'm now looking forward and how I'm going to spend my coming years. And I'm now taking on this kind of advisory role in the family, and I'm passing the responsibilities over. And in, you know, look, in modern Japan, it's kind of taken on slightly different meanings around personal growth and travel and hobbies. And is now a much more active and dynamic stage of life. So, yeah, I love the concept. I think if we really start thinking about that in a way that, you know, we get to age 60, this is now a forward-looking, forward-thinking stage of life that we can celebrate everything that we've achieved, but now think about more personal growth, more about ourselves. It's not about giving to our families. You know, we give our time and our energy to our families that are probably grown up enough to now take responsibility for their thing. How can we look forward and how can we have that second childhood? I love that definition. How can we now feel childlike again and explore and be curious?
And yeah, I love the sound of that. I'm reading Happy Money by Ken Honda. I don't know if you know the book. Do you know the book, Happy Money?
I know the book. I've not read it, but I know the book, yeah.
There's so much in it, but the one little story that I remember, he says how growing up, his father was an accountant, I think. He would meet rich people that were happy and rich people that were unhappy. He spent his life trying to figure out how can you be both rich and be happy. And there's so many different Japanese concepts in the book that you introduced in your writing as well. I think there's a lot that we can learn from that part of the world. And that book, I think, does a remarkable job introducing us to some of it. The other thing that I heard when you said the 60 and the transition, and the fact that you can think of the transition between generations before you're gone. And it's such a powerful concept to me because I work with people that inherit wealth, and there's this saying and truth that when you receive an inheritance, it means somebody passed away, but it also means that the person you need the most in this moment is no longer there to help, guide, and answer questions. You were talking about warm giving. An inheritance could be a gift of love, and the context, how it's passed along matters. But the fact that you could start the transition that you're aware of, it will happen early on when you're still around, so you can actually sit down with the kids and grandkids and have a conversation, and nephews and nieces and cousins and relatives. But I think there's a powerful idea that you can start it way, way earlier than we think. And it doesn't all have to happen the minute we're actually gone.
Yeah. And actually, that presents, you know, a whole host of challenges for the people that you're leaving the money behind, doesn't it? I think if you, as you said, it's you're passing on a huge amount of responsibility to deal, not only to deal with the grief, but to deal with the estate. The money becomes second. I've also seen a lot of this where people have a real tough time in unconnecting the money. So you leave them this bunch of money, but that was my dad's or my mum's money that they never got to spend. How we acquire money has a massive impact on how we feel about it and how we spend it. I've told this story on my podcast, but my wife got left about £10,000 from her mum when her mum passed away quite quickly. It was shares that she had in the company that she worked for. And that's still sitting in my wife's bank account. It's not her money. She can't connect to it. How we acquire it, both whether we've sold a business, whether we've won it, and you hear about this, right? If you kind of win lotteries, people blow it quickly because it has no meaning. I think we need to be really mindful of that. If we believe that we're not going to give away our money to our family, our friends, causes, charities during our lifetime, we're going to build it all the way up to the end, we need to understand that that might not have the impact that you think it's going to have, particularly if you don't have the conversations along the way. Because how that money has been acquired by the people you're leaving it to can have a big impact on how they feel that if they can or can't spend it. Mostly, I see that they have real trouble in connecting with it, and it becomes a massive burden, not something that's celebrated.
It's such a powerful topic, and it could be an episode by itself, but it's the idea, not how much you give or leave behind, but how you do it. How do you give it? That has an importance. And you touch on something fascinating that I've seen in my own professional experience, that it could lead to two extreme situations. One, whoever inherits wants to blow through it, kind of get rid of it, sort of like an emotional burden, let it out of sight, out of picture, make it go away. And sometimes it's a subconscious series of decisions that lead to it, poor investment choices and so on. And the second one is complete denial that it's even there, and not even admitting that it's there, just ignoring it. And I think there might be some path in the middle where maybe that guidance from the previous generation would allow the next generation to embrace it in a way that's productive, useful, and just find a way to communicate about it sooner, so they're not surprised, shocked about it, and don't react in such an extreme way. And it's not all very conscious. Yeah. Sometimes it's a very subconscious. And as an observer, outsider, you can see where it's going. But maybe the individual may not even realize why they're doing what they're doing. It's fascinating to see, but goes back to what you mentioned. Start that conversation early on, as soon as you can.
Yeah. And just my experience tells me that if I bring that conversation into people and I show them through thoughtful, real financial planning, that you have the ability to do two things, either give it away during your lifetime now or leave it to the end. No one chooses the end. They only choose the end because they're fearful of running out of money, right? That's where the fear comes in. So, you know, that I'm going to leave a legacy. They're not saying that. What they're saying is I'm fearful of running out of money. That's what they're saying. And so if you take away the fear or deal with the fear with facts and planning and thoughtful conversations about running out of money, everybody I've worked with has chosen to give money during their lifetime. if you had the choice, you would absolutely give it. So yeah, I think it's a real key area of thought.
It's a powerful revelation and a lesson there. Dan, I have one last question for you. I'm always curious about the definition of success. How do you think about success on all the levels you want to explore with me today?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, you must go through this. You manage money for people. You deal with people's lives. Sometimes what we define is kind of put on the back burner a little bit, right?
Right.
So, but I've got a pretty clear understanding, and it's developed through you know childhood that you mentioned before and all the learning. So there's three things for me. Number one, own my own time. Yeah, own my own time, I think, is really, really important. Having freedom to be curious, I think, is really, really important. I'm this kind of childhood thing, second childhood, being curious to climb trees, you know, that kind of concept in childhood, being free to explore and be curious, and then feel contented or feel contentment. So yeah, those would be my three things. Own my time, have freedom to be curious, and feel contentment. That's my definition of being successful.
I like the sound of that, especially freedom. Freedom as a word has come up in so many conversations in my podcast. And it's fascinating how, you know, we start talking about money, but actually a lot of conversations, we end up talking about time. And then if I look for one word, I say, do you mean freedom? And a lot of people say, yes, that's what I mean. An absolute freedom to pursue your curiosity, to pursue the things you like, and also the freedom away from things, as you mentioned before. There are certain things you don't feel like doing, like washing your car. You want to have the freedom not to do it. It takes 11 pounds to get out of that commitment. So there you go.
Exactly that, yeah.
Dan, thank you so much for today. This was remarkable, and I'll include all the links, but you're doing some really great work introducing people to some concepts and giving them the tools to prepare for something that many of us will have to face. And maybe we could have some practice rounds early on and figure out how to prepare better for the better years, that the second act, the glory years that are ahead.
I appreciate the invite, and thank you for the conversation. It's been really cool. Thank you.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes, and so are the opinions of the host and employee and partner of a registered investment advisor and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on the firm is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available on advisorinfo.sec.gov.